Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, November the 4th, 2011. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by my co-host, Tara Gardner. Hello, Tara.
Hello.
Oh, try again.
Sorry.
Try again now.
Hi.
There we are.
Hi there. On
today's show, I'm pleased to be able to feature segments pertaining to the upcoming Interactive Futures Conference at Emily Carr University here in Vancouver, which will be based on the theme of animal influence. Our first interview, in fact, is with one of the key organizers of the conference. Carol Gigliotti is here with us today to give us an introduction to what this one-of-a-kind event will be all about. Interactive Futures 2011, taking place from November 17th to 19th, will be featuring the work of media artists whose efforts have been influenced by the growing wealth of knowledge on animal behavior, cognition, creativity, and consciousness emerging from such fields as ecology, cognitive ethology, psychology, neuroscience, cognitive science, philosophy, zoology, and others. There's obviously a lot there that has the potential to be covered at this three-day event, and Carol will be highlighting for us some of the variety of presentations that will be featured at the conference. And for our feature interview, we will have the keynote speaker of the conference, Dr. Mark Beckoff, on the show with us today to give us a taste of the topics on animal influence that he will be addressing at the Interactive Futures event. Mark Beckoff is a professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado and a world-leading ethologist who has been studying animal behavior for many years and in turn publishing over 20 books and 200 papers on the subject on the inner lives of animals, including subtopics of animal emotions, conscious, and morality. I will be speaking to him today about the morality of animals based on one of his latest books entitled Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals. I read this book earlier this week and we'll have some commentary to share on that coming up soon as well. But before we get to that, Tara, you have some commentary to share with us about Mattel's recent foray into the promotion of animal cruelty among children. Please tell us about that.
Yeah, so basically Mattel has put out this new toy. Basically, the theme for this toy is saving a scuba diver from a man-eating shark. The toy includes a man-eating shark with red eyes and has a chomping action with big, fierce white teeth. It includes a boat with a harpoon for killing and seizing the shark, a scuba diver, and a captain, and it is rated for ages 4 and up. The toy only has one review on Mattel's website, and luckily it's by a diver that had this to say. This is a horrible product. As sharks are being driven to extinction by overfishing and wasteful practices of shark finning, this toy sends the wrong message to our children. Save a diver? No diver I know would ever support the killing of a shark to be saved. The movie Jaws has spread an irrational fear of sharks, and Peter Benchley now regrets even having written the book. I suggest that the product manager for this toy do a little research on the current state of shark conservation and diver attitudes towards sharks. Epic, epic, epic fail. So I really appreciated this.
We need to get some more reviews on there, I think.
yeah, absolutely. I tried writing a review, and it says that they review the reviews, I guess, but I mean, I don't think they reviewed that previous review.
So are you saying they only put favorable reviews? What's the point of having a review?
I'm not sure.
If it's going to be censored.
Yeah, it says that there's a delay and that it'll take a while before the reviews get posted up. But obviously that doesn't happen all the time, I guess. So I tried posting one, but it's not up there yet. So for each review, you can vote saying whether the review was helpful or not. So of course I agreed with what this review had to say. And I encourage our listeners to go online to shop.mattel.com and search for shark, then post your own review. And you can also scroll to the bottom of the page and click on the Contact Us link to voice your concern to the company. Sharks are a vital part of our oceans ecosystem, and our children need to revere them for the part that they play in that ecosystem, not fear them and the oceans. And you can also go to our website as well, Animal Voices. Radio.com and
animalvoices.org, you mean?
.org, sorry. I always do that. I assume it's .com. And we'll have a link up there as well for
we
you to follow.
We do have a link. So we have a link on there to if you wanted to post a review. And we actually have the phone number for Mattel and a link to their email contact form if you want to tell them that it is the, what are we in, the 21st century? And as someone on Facebook noticed, it's 2011. It's not cool to kill whales. It's also not cool to kill sharks. Mm-hmm. So as for the message that we're sending out our children, that what killing sharks is a good thing? No, it's not. And I don't think we should be promoting this type of animal cruelty towards little ones whose minds are going to be molded with these types of toys, you know, toy guns, that's, you know, toy shark killing machines.
Absolutely.
It's all kind of the same. So
absolutely. Yeah.
So yeah. So
and I think also that, you know, this is a very serious decision when somebody decides to kill a shark. I know people do it because, you know, there was an attack or something like that, and, you know, I don't agree with that personally, but even the people that do, they make those decisions. It's a very serious decision to make, and it shouldn't be, you know, put in the hands of children thinking they can just make these kinds of decisions willy-nilly, you know?
Exactly. Well, thank you for that. So in preparation for my interview with ethologist Mark Beckhoff today, I read his book Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals this week, and I'd like to talk about the book and some of the provocative and profound ideas raised in this work. First, I want to start by qualifying Mark's expertise in the area of animal behavior. As much as a non-human animal can have insight into this vast region of complex expressions of other species. Known as the world's leading human expert on animal emotions, Dr. Mark Beckhoff has spent many, many years of behavioral and cognitive research into the lives of animals, and he presents the results of his research via a marriage of very scientific and logistical explanations combined with anecdotal evidence. He has written many previous books on the subject of animal behavior, and if you're interested in learning more, some other recommended readings include The Animal Manifesto, The Emotional Lives of Animals, and The Ten Trusts, What We Must Do to Care for the Animals We Love. I have read the latter two of these and found that this book, Wild Justice, nicely complemented the themes of the previous works that I've read. Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals, which is co-written by philosopher Jessica Pierce, makes the claim that some animals have morality and thus exhibit moral behavior, which is documented in the book via moving and much evidence of behaviors of fairness, empathy, altruism, reciprocity, trust, and justice in the animal world. Digging into the evidence of these behaviors takes you on a journey over hills, into valleys, and around turns, as the authors say, because you can't just describe a chimpanzee's penchant for fairness and leave it at that. This is only a starting point from which we then work backwards to discover for ourselves the complex societal and physiological structures from whence this behavior originates. And I won't get into those details in this review as there's just too much to go into, but read the book if you are so inclined to learn more. What I'd like to discuss are the messages that one takes away from the reading of this book when it comes to deliberating and accepting ideas of animal morality in our often closed-minded human worldview. As the authors say, some of the most important philosophical questions arise in relation to the definition of morality and the extension of this term to include non-human animals. And in including some animals within the sphere of morality, we force a reconsideration of what have been assumed to be the essential ingredients of morality, elements such as reflective judgment, agency, and conscience. I think that once all the evidence has been carefully considered on the parts of us human beings, we are forced to reflect ourselves upon how we consider our fellow inhabitants of the earth, once realizing that we share with them what we may consider a concrete building block of societal mutual respect for others, and that is morality. Once we accept our resemblance on this level with our fellow creatures, we can no longer ignore their rights to be treated with the care and reverence as the animals, the living beings who they are. And this initiates the mutual respect for our fellow beings with which this world has long fallen out of touch. And the authors do discuss the issue that many people apparently are uncomfortable with the idea of ascribing morality to animals. Why is this so? Because it threatens the uniqueness of human beings, is the general conclusion. One clever refutation that the authors make to this excuse steers to the premise that human uniqueness cannot logically serve as ethical justification for the instrumental use of animals. So in other words, one has nothing to do with the other, and furthermore, any uniqueness, read superiority, that we humans, which we are animals, may feel we exhibit gives no justification to abuse the non-human animals. And even further to that, not only must we not abuse animals, but we must exercise ethical responsibilities towards them, which is a theme raised in the book. Once we accept that animals have morality, it is up to us to reconsider our attitudes and actions towards them. As the authors of Wild Justice say, morality is a spectrum of behaviors that share the common feature of concern about the welfare of others. And to this end, the message that one can ultimately take from the book is for us to use our own morality to reevaluate our ideas and preconceptions and to extend the same kind of respect to non-human animals as we would to our own moral species.
Listen to Sound Resistance on CFRO, Vancouver's co-op radio at 102.7 FM. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
So you are listening to the Animal Voices radio show here on 102.7 FM, CFRO, Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And now I have our upcoming events. So today, Friday, November the 4th at 6:15 p.m., there will be a demonstration at the Vancouver Aquarium, which is organized by CATCA, Campaigns Against the Cruelty to Animals. This is happening at 845 Avison Way in Stanley Park in Vancouver, which is the location of the Vancouver Aquarium. Participants at this demonstration will be greeting high donors as they arrive for the year's largest aquarium fundraiser. It will be a candlelight vigil for marine mammals exploited by Aquarium for Profit. Just meet at the aquarium entrance if you wish to participate. And once again, that's tonight at 6:15 p.m. Happening tomorrow, the much-anticipated very first inaugural vegan prom in Vancouver. This is happening at the Wise Hall tomorrow night, 8 p.m. to midnight, and the Wise Hall is located at 1882 Adenex Street in Vancouver. So as we've been saying, it's time to get ready, Vancouver, because your first ever vegan prom is coming. It's coming. Well, it's almost here. And you're going, right, Tara?
Yes, yes. I'm really excited about it. I can't wait to be surrounded by, you know, other vegans and surrounded by lots of vegan food. And
it's for non-vegans, too. It's for anyone, as I'm trying to convince my non-vegan friends to go. Especially if you're a guy, I think it would be a great place to meet compassionate single women. So there you go. Today is actually the last day to buy tickets online. So if you want to go, get your tickets now.
Yes, I've been putting it off. I need to get it tonight.
Get your ticket now. So there's going to be a buffet of finger foods, cash bar, a photo booth, a raffle, and a way to leave anonymous notes for your secret vegan crushes.
Oh,
you're guaranteed to have a great time. So tickets are on sale, I believe, still in person at Carmivore, which is the vegan store at 610 Columbia Street in New Westminster. Nice Shoes just got some more tickets in at 3568 Fraser Street in Vancouver. And Edible Flowers has them, too, at Arbutus and West Broadway. They are $15 a piece, cash only, if you're buying them in person. And a reminder that it's age 19 and up, as there is a cash bar. And once again, you also can order them online only today from the Vegan Prom website. Just go to www.veganprom.yvr for more information on how to do that. The Vancouver Vegan Prom is co-sponsored by Animal Voices Radio, and we at Animal Voices will be there. On Monday, November the 7th, from 7 till 9 p.m., there is a very important potluck and meeting by Stop UBC Animal Research. It's taking place at 1656 Adenac Street in Vancouver. So this is a meeting open to those who wish to find out more about Stop UBC Animal Research's work and to possibly get involved with future efforts of the group. This meeting is a critical one. With UBC's shocking announcement last week that it used more than 200,000 animals in research in 2010, Stop's campaign needs to develop a campaign response. So please be there if you wish to be involved, as it is a potluck as well. Bring some vegan food and drink. Also bring your own cups so that they don't have to waste paper or plastic. Please RSVP so that they know how many people will be attending. And you can RSVP on Facebook by finding this potluck meeting listed as an event on Stop UBC Animal Research's Facebook page. And finally, I want to talk about the Interactive Futures Animal Influence Conference that we will be talking about furthermore on the show. This is happening from November 17th to 19th, coming up soon this month, featuring such guests as respected cognitive ethicist Mark Beckhoff and international new media artist Lisa Jevbrat. This year's Interactive Futures Conference will be focused on the ways that art is influenced by our growing knowledge of the emotional, cognitive, and moral lives of animals. Animal Influence will host a workshop in concurrent exhibitions, performances, screenings that will offer opportunities for in-depth conversations and discussions between invited cognitive ethologists, biologists, psychologists, philosophers, artists, and public policymakers whose work has helped to shift assumed conventions concerning animal cognition, consciousness, and agency, as well as reveal possibilities for the development of new media implementing image, text, and sound and video. To learn more about this event, go to interactivefutures.ca. You can also register there. If you have an animal-friendly event that you would like to have announced on the show, please email us the details at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com, or you can post it on our Facebook page as well, which is Animal Voices Vancouver. And now we have our first interview on the Animal Influence Interactive Futures Conference coming up. Today's first interview is with Carol Gigliotti, who is an associate professor of dynamic media and critical and cultural studies at Emily Carr University in Vancouver, where she teaches environmental ethics, critical animal studies, and digital interactive media courses. In this respect, she is one of the key organizers of Emily Carr University's Interactive Futures Conference this year, which takes place from November 17th to 19th, and whose theme this year is called Animal Influence, spotlighting nationally and internationally recognized media artists' work influenced by the growing wealth of knowledge on animal behavior, cognition, creativity, and consciousness. Hello, Carol, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, thank you so much.
So I wanted to have you speak on the show about this conference because it's an event like none other that I've heard of before, and I'm excited to know more about it. A conference that focuses on media artists' work influenced by animal behavior, cognition, creativity, and consciousness. Please tell us more about that and exactly what components the conference will entail.
Thank you, Allison. Interactive Futures is an ongoing conference at Emily Carr University, and this will be the sixth iteration. But this theme for this particular year is animal influence, and I am the curator for that with the executive director, Maria Lantan, of Interactive Futures, and Julie Andreev, who's the artistic director. And Animal Influence this year offers a workshop in which media artists, scientists, critics, philosophers, biologists will discuss and debate these emerging ideas, as well as we will be offering two exhibitions, one at Emily Carr University Concourse Gallery and one at the downtown gallery, Gachet Gallery. We'll also be offering performances and screenings. And after the conference is over, we will be publishing with the international journal Antenna, which is the Journal of Nature and Visual Culture, and we're going to be doing a special issue with them. Festigations are affecting the ways in which new media artists are considering broader understandings of other species and how they're creating varying methodologies for experimental art and new media, methodologies that are appropriate for these unique circumstances. So, for instance, examples of the outcomes of these explorations would include and do include in this conference and event films, animations, interactive installations, proprietary software, internet-based social media works, robotics, videos, and performances.
This all sounds like super cutting edge, and as I said, something that I haven't heard of before, an event like this. Who is this event for, and I'm curious why the theme of animal influence was chosen this year?
Well, the study of animal-human relations has really exploded in the humanities and social sciences in the last, let's say, maybe 8 years. A growing number of scholars are addressing animal identities and the subjectivity and language of animals, representation of animals, the exploitation of animals, and the cultures of human-animal relations, and actually the culture of animals themselves. So artists also have begun to incorporate this growing body of research from a number of disciplines, emerging studies in ethology, which is the study of animals in the field, cognitive ethology, which is really the study of animal cognition and sort of comparing different kinds of cognitive skills and different kinds of cognition throughout species, and connected disciplines such as ecology, psychology, neuroscience, cognitive science, philosophy, zoology, and many others, really. And in so doing, to ask and attempt to answer a broad array of questions about animals. So for us, a certain amount of risk was inherent in this project for both the artists and the curators and anyone who really is involved in it, because while the change in human attitudes towards animals has been documented, you know, in news media, we see all kinds of animal stories now that once, perhaps something once a week, now we're seeing constant news items and things, of course, on the internet, and actually in academic venues as well. The idea that an animal, that animals in general might possess emotional, moral, cognitive lives, is an idea that has been in the past really more associated with metaphorical or symbolic approaches in the arts. The emphasis in this project on animal consciousness, animal cognition, animal creativity, and agency in combination with technological and media approaches, we think will offer audiences new, provocative, and yet really accessible experiences on which to draw in reevaluating our relationships with all those more than human nations with which we share this planet. The challenge in curating this was drawing out themes in content and methodology that had really informed artistic investigations in this area. And what we wanted to do was make more visible and accessible to the public what is often a unique blend of processes and concepts and ideas from many sources. So our goal was really to document, enhance, and encourage these unique, innovative, and valuable influences with the support of a public outreach grant from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council and the BC Arts Council. So we've really been funded from governmental sources, which is pretty interesting. We were able to open the exhibitions, the screenings, and performances to the public, and also hold this in-depth conference with speakers from many disciplines, all focused on this topic.
So I'd like to ask you about the conference schedule. I can see that the program is packed full of presenters and activities. Can you highlight some of the presenters of particular interest who will be featured at the conference?
Yeah, we have two keynote speakers. One is an artist, and the other one is an internationally known artist, and the other one is a very well-known biologist. The artist is Lisa Jebrat, who is an artist from UCLA. I'm sorry, UC Santa Barbara, Lisa Jebrat, and she actually has been teaching a course on interspecies communication and has been developing software that allows people to be able to see the way, for instance, with Photoshop, be able to see the way an animal might. So if and that will that's actually a piece in the show. Mm-hmm. Mark Beckoff is quite a catch for us. He is a well-known
quite a catch for me too. I'll be interviewing him later on in the show today.
Right, exactly. So I won't go into that too much, but quite a influential biologist in who talks about the emotional and moral lives of animals and why they matter. There is a French artist, actually the French consulate has been generous to us and was very interested in this theme and is supporting the French artist Franz Cadet, who works with robotics and has done a number of pieces. A lot of her work is about the effect of our relationship with animals in terms of biotechnology and robotics. And so she's going to be showing and also speaking at the opening. We also have a U.S. group called EcoArt Tech, which has been working on these themes and themes about the environment for quite some time. And they're doing a social media piece called Training Your, spelled YR Human, which is about the dog that they live with, an Akita, who actually, obviously, is kind of training them. So we have a number of films, and we have both local and international artists. So we're really excited about the kinds of things that we're going to be able to bring. For probably the major performance and the night of the performances is Monkey, which is a one-person performance by Deke Weaver, who has performed at Sundance and is getting kind of rave reviews for his one-person performances, and is well known for his website called The Unreliable Bestiary.
That is a lot of interesting and fascinating material that will be occurring at the Interactive Futures Animal Influence Conference at Emily Carr University in Vancouver, which is coming up on November 17th to 19th. 2011. For more information on the conference and to register, please visit www.interactivefutures.ca. Thank you, Carol, for coming on the show today to speak to us about this.
Thank you so much for having me.
So that was the Interactive Futures Conference. And Tara, you have our news for us now.
Yes. You are listening to Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM, CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. So, in the news this week, we have emergency flood relief needed in Bangkok, Thailand. Your help is urgently needed to save the lives of dogs and cats affected by severe flooding in the Bangkok region. Large-scale evacuations of people are currently occurring in the worst affected areas of Bangkok, in the Bangkok area. People being evacuated are typically not allowed to take their pets, and these dogs and cats, as well as thousands of strays left behind, need your help now. Soy Dog is working with groups in the Bangkok area to rescue these animals. These groups are not large animal welfare agencies, but rather smaller groups working around the clock to save these dogs and cats before it is too late. Time is running out and they need your help. Your support will go towards rescue, veterinary care, shelter, rehoming, and rehoming of the dogs and cats. Please donate as generously as you can. Time is of the essence and saving the lives of these animals. Please go to www.soidog.org to donate.
And Soy Dog, or we're not sure exactly how you say it, is an animal rescue organization in Thailand, right?
Yes, yes, exactly. They do. They take in strays and find new homes for them, as well as veterinary care and that kind of stuff. And in other news, Subway's new vegan patty. Have you heard about this one?
Sure have. Used to be a big fan of it when it was just the veggie patty.
Yeah. And that wasn't vegan. It was just vegetarian. It had egg in it. But now they have a totally vegan patty. So select Subway restaurants in Canada have begun offering an all vegan patty for sandwiches, dubbed the Totally Vegged Vegetable Patty. The cruelty-free creation was implemented after the company received customer requests like those from Compassion Over Killing's website We Love Subway.com campaign. So it's only in select restaurants, apparently, in Ontario and British Columbia. So
So Veg News magazine was saying it's only available in one restaurant in BC, but yeah. We know otherwise because yeah. We're in BC, and you said you're seeing the signs all around town, right?
Yeah, I've been seeing them at lots of different locations. I was on Facebook, and I saw some friends, you know, posted that there was one around Fraser Street. Yeah, and so somewhere. I was downtown, and I saw a sign in the window, and I went in and ordered one. And
you know what I think is, our listeners out there, if you are finding these subways that have the vegan patty, posted on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, as to where the location is.
That's a great idea. Yeah, we can find out how many locations are actually doing this. But yeah, I went in and I tried it and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was, you know, really good. So definitely
You give some substance to the sandwich, you know, because ever since they discontinued that vegetarian patty that they used to have.
You just get the veggie delight, which is just vegetables.
It's just vegetables, right? Like, you want the cheese? No. Okay, do you want lettuce and tomato or whatever? That's it. I mean, give us some substance. Vegans like substance.
Yeah. So it's nice to have that option. So definitely go out and support it. You can also go to subway.com and click on the contact us link at the bottom of the page to show your support and, you know, that you encourage them to have more options like this. In other news, Leona Lewis is looking for the next big cruelty-free designer. So she's put out...
Singer,
yes. She's put out a call to submit wardrobe ideas that she would like to wear on stage. In addition to a cash prize, the winner will go to work with the singer and her team to finalize the winning outfit. So, of course, the longtime vegetarian requires that all submissions be totally cruelty-free. The rules say designers must not require any leather or any other materials derived from animals for the finalized outfit, i.e. must be animal friendly. So perhaps this will inspire designers who use animal parts to think outside of the leather box.
That sounds great. Thank you for the news.
Yeah, no problem.
Mark Beckhoff is a former professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado Boulder and is a fellow of the Animal Behavior Society and a past Guggenheim Fellow. In 2000, he was awarded the Exemplar Award from the Animal Behavior Society for major long-term contributions to the field of animal behavior. Mark is also an ambassador for Jane Goodall's Roots and Shoots program, in which he works with students of all ages, senior citizens, and prisoners, and also is a member of the Ethics Committee of the Jane Goodall Institute. He and Jane co-founded the organization Ethologists for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, Citizens for Responsible Animal Behavior Studies, in the year 2000. Mark's main areas of research include animal behavior, cognitive ethology, which is the study of animal minds, and behavioral ecology. And he has also published more than 200 papers and 20 books on animal issues. One of his more recent books is called Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals, co-authored with Jessica Pierce, and will be speaking on the issue of the morality of animals today, as discussed in his book. Mark will also be in Vancouver later this month for the Interactive Futures Conference at Emily Carr University, speaking on some of these issues. Hello, Mark, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Thanks, Allison. It's great to be on your show, and I'm really looking forward to coming up to the meeting in BC in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, thank you for coming on the show today. I'm a fan of your work and writings on animal behavior and have just finished reading your book entitled Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals, in which you discuss the morality of animals. You argue in this book that animals have morality, that they feel empathy for each other, treat one another fairly, cooperate towards common goals, and help each other out of trouble. Before we get to that, however, can you start by defining to our listeners what morality is exactly? In the book, you say it's a social phenomenon and acts as a social glue.
Right. I mean, it's difficult to give a precise definition that somebody can't pick apart. But actually, just today, Jessica Pierce, who's the co-author on Wild Justice, and I, we're writing a paper on social justice in animals. And we basically look at morality as like an umbrella term. It captures what people call fairness, justice, cooperation, reciprocity, empathy. And so basically that's how we cash it out. It generally defines a group of behaviors that indicate that an animal knows right from wrong. An individual, of course, knows right from wrong. And it basically defines what would be the appropriate and or, you know, the opposite would be the inappropriate thing to do in a certain social situation. So that's how we look at it. It's a big umbrella term.
So when we speak of morality in animals, you warn that we must be wary of generalizing these characteristics among the non-animal species groups as a whole, since not all species' natures are alike, which makes sense to me. One wolf pack, as you say, may constitute as what's right differently than another wolf pack. Can you speak of the danger of this generalization with how it applies to the individuality of different animal groups?
Yeah, that's a great question. In Wild Justice, the book we talked about, one aspect was the facial ecology of morality. And there we were just cautioning people about, well, like in the canids, who are members of the dog family, not to expect to see the same sorts of behavior, say, in more solitary red foxes, more social coyotes, and, of course, highly social wolves. They will have different mechanisms for resolving conflict and or avoiding conflict and behaving properly. But it also goes further within species. So just like in a human group, you know, there might be one code of conduct that applies in one group but not in another. And that requires, like, really detailed knowledge of the social dynamics of individuals within a group and what would be right and wrong within that group. And so we're just being cautious to say that while it may look in one group, you know, pack of wolves where, say, you know, a dominant animal does something to a subordinate animal, it may not look like it's a moral or a just behavior. But if you know about the dynamics in between those two individuals, it would be understandable. So right now it's so early in our research that we just want to be very careful about generalizing across species and even within a species.
It makes sense. You wouldn't generalize like that across the human species, for example. We have all different societies and, of course, come from
different
backgrounds and cultures.
Yeah, exactly. It's like
cross-cultural,
different types of groups, the goals of the groups, right. And that's a good way to put it. So just as we want to be really careful to pay attention to the details in human animals, we want to be careful to pay attention to the details in non-human animals.
And when we apply the notion of morality to animal species other than our own, you talk about the idea of drawing a line as to who the moral animals are and that doing so is an exercise in futility. Can you explain why this is so? And is it actually possible to draw such a line and claim that these animals are moral, but these ones are not?
Yeah, you know, once again, I always say that if we ever draw lines among species, you know, excluding some species or including others within some realm, we need to draw it with a pencil because we're going to erase it. So, for example, just this week I learned about some interesting studies that looked at punishment in fish, where certain species of fish will punish animals who steal food. It's not right for them to do so, if you will. So I think we need to keep the doors open as to which species might show moral behavior, which won't. But I also want to be a realist to say that I don't think mosquitoes have the neural apparatus to show moral behavior. So, you know, oftentimes when you're doing this kind of work, you say, well, yeah, I think we see moral behavior in chimpanzees and elephants and wolves and, you know, other mammals. There's some good examples in ravens punishing other ravens who steal food. And now we see this punishment behavior in fish. But I think that, you know, we don't want to feed into the skeptics who say, oh, well, what about spiders and mosquitoes? I suppose you think they show moral behavior. And the answer is no, I don't.
The
line drawing is something we need to avoid because we don't have the data yet. So line drawing would be just really premature.
Some scientists complain about anthropomorphizing, that is, ascribing human traits to non-human animals when it comes to talking about animals and morality, and say that it is not science to do so. What do you have to say to these types of accusations?
My take on anthropomorphism is a simple one, and that is it's not a worry. And the reason I say that, it's usually double talk. So if I say, for example, an elephant in captivity isn't happy, the critics will say, oh, you're just being anthropomorphic. She's happy.
Mm-hmm.
and then it gets real silent. Because saying an animal is happy or experiencing joy and pleasure is being anthropomorphic in the true definition of the word. So the way I look at it, because I'm a biologist, is Charles Darwin, who's a really famous biologist, you know, he wrote On the Origin of Species and responsible for the theory of natural selection, basically said that we see evolutionary continuity among different animals, and that means that there's shades of gray, not black and white differences among animals. And the bumper sticker for continuity is, if we have something, they, other animals, have it too. So we're not inserting something human into non-human animals. So I just look at anthropomorphism, to be honest with you right now, as just being a ploy for skeptics to say, oh, you're just being anthropomorphic, and to stop the discussion of what we're really learning about the fascinating lives of other animals.
That's how I see it, too. And I think you say in your book, too, to even say the opposite, no, that elephant isn't happy, that's anthropomorphizing as well. So
exactly.
In essence,
so
they're doing it themselves.
Using these terms, then basically we just need to be very careful that we're consistent. And so, like I said, you know, if I say, look, you know, this chimpanzee in a lab is miserable, and people say, oh, you're being anthropomorphic, yeah, she's happy,
right,
they're being anthropomorphic too. So it's just the kind of thing we just really need to stop.
So I'd like to talk about fairness, which is one of the clusters that falls under the umbrella of morality in creatures, as you discuss in the book. You say that some animals seem to have a sense of fairness and that they understand and behave according to implicit rules about who deserves what and when. Can you give us some examples of how these behaviors may play out in the animal world?
Well, yeah, I mean, one might be showing empathy to an animal who's injured. There's being another, you know, it might be the way in which food is shared, or whether animals will cooperate with one another to get food, which they will. And, you know, you'll see various animals. You'll see wolves. You'll see primates cooperate to get food and then share the food. One individual doesn't really steal it. And you'll also see some really interesting studies. One's been done on capuchin monkeys. The other's been done on dogs that show that if you have animals who can see one another and they see the reward that they're getting, and say they're both all getting monkey chow or dog bones, and then you change the reward, mm-hmm, so you give the monkeys a grape or a date, or you give the dogs a marrow bone, the animals who are still being given the lesser, lower-valued food will stop doing what they're supposed to do to get the reward. So there's this, the fancy word for it is called inequity aversion, but when you really cash it out, it just means that animals don't like being treated unfairly, nor do human animals.
Mm-hmm.
So once again, we're learning as time goes on, because, you know, I really want to stress this is the early stages of research into moral behavior of animals. We're learning that a lot of species show this aversion to being treated unfairly, and we see a lot of caregiving to animals who need it. And, of course, in my long-term studies of play behavior, we see fairness being shown, you know, constantly.
So let's talk about empathy. Empathy is the ability to perceive and feel the emotion of another. In the book, you say, we like to believe that our tendencies toward empathy and kindness are stronger than our tendencies toward cruelty and meanness. And we can also entertain the notion that it is the same in animal societies. So what do you think? Is it the same for animals?
Oh, yeah. I think the data that are coming out really clearly in all animal species who have been studied is that more than 90% of their behavior is what we call prosocial or positive, which could be empathic, altruistic, cooperative, collaborative, reciprocal. And so the line that I always push is we've been basically duped by sensationalistic media and misreadings of Darwin to think that empathy and these pro-social or positive behaviors are byproducts, as we would say in biology, of strong selection for competition. No, what we're basically showing now very clearly is that empathy and these pro-social behaviors evolve on their own. And there's been recent books, one by Peter Corning called The Fairness Instinct, another by Steve Pinker, another by Doug Fry, all showing that our natural proclivity in humans and in non-human animals is to be fair, cooperative, empathic, pro-social, if you will. And once again, it's really exciting because we're basically demonstrating, you know, that there's the roots of human empathy and human moral behavior in non-human animals.
Well, you give many examples of empathy in animal societies in your book, and the one that particularly got to me was you were talking about the study where I think it was adults. There was an adult in the room who had the child, human child, and the dog, and the adult was acting upset, and it actually affected the dog more so than the human child. So what does that say about empathy in non-human animals versus humans?
Well, I think when you look at dogs, because of their close history to us, you know, during domestication, it's understandable, and it was a young child. But once again, you're raising these great points about people studying not only empathy within species, but across species. Mm-hmm. And there's examples, this great one from the tsunami where we had this one-year-old hippopotamus basically become attached to a 100-year-old tortoise.
Oh, we all know that story, right?
You know, providing care to one another, for example. Mm-hmm. I think that the examples that we're seeing, animals who refuse to feed when they feed, another animal gets shocked.
That would be in a scientific experiment.
The two studies that were done early on were like in the 1960s. So these data are not brand new. One study was done on rats, another was done on monkeys, showing clearly that animals were assessing what happened when they ate, and if they took food and another animal got shocked, they stopped feeding.
So let's talk about justice. First, can you define for our listeners what justice is?
Not really clearly. Jessica and I were talking, like I said, we're talking about this today, looking once again as justice as a broad umbrella term that incorporates fairness, cooperation, reciprocity, different forms of morality, different forms of pro-social and basically positive behaviors. But when we talk about justice, you know, we're basically talking that something is deserved. You know, you got your just dessert, if you will. And so that's why, you know, earlier on we were talking about, you know, within and between species moral behavior. We could say the same about, you know, justice, that you might say, oh, well, that's not really just, but if you knew the details of the social dynamics within a wolf pack or in a human group, you might say, well, that was just, but it may not be just or moral in another a group of humans or another pack of wolves. So we're playing with this a lot because it's a very powerful term, and you know, people really are really interested in social justice issues. So once again, I will appeal to Darwin and say that if you find justice in humans, you're going to find it in non-human animals, and in many ways it may look a lot alike, and you might also see the variations across say animal groups as you see in human groups.
So in the book you say that animals, like people, can lose their moral bearing when their society has been disruptive, which is one reason to conserve these societies. I found that a really interesting point for you to make, as I haven't read anyone else make that point before. Can you elaborate what you meant by this idea?
Well, in the non-human groups, but I think you see it in human groups during war.
Very much so.
We could cast these out as being exploited populations. And when non-human animals and human animals are exploited, they might be abused from out the outside, they're stressed, they may be living in fear and terror, we do see the loss of empathy and what we might call, you know, the loss of morality. And the reason I think this is very important is because some of the research that's done on social behavior in animals is done in captivity, where these animals are stressed, and once again, you may not see certain patterns of behavior that look like moral behavior, justice, fairness, cooperation in captivity, because these animals are basically stressed and living in fear and terror. So that question is a really loaded and important one, yeah. Allison, because what it means is that in the non-human animals, we really need to be very careful that we don't base all our conclusions about what animals especially can't do when we're looking at captive animals.
So why is morality like a game, and how does social play in animals provide insights into morality?
Well, the research I've done and some others are now doing show very clearly that when animals play, they use different behavior patterns. They'll use behavior patterns from what we call aggressive behavior, predatory behavior, sexual behavior. So, you know, if I'm playing with you, I might bite you really hard. That looks like I'm trying to dominate you or eat you. I might mount you. That looks like I might be trying to mate with you. So during play, there's all these possibilities that different behavior patterns will be misinterpreted. And what we see across species is they've evolved what we call play initiation signals. So the best one, and most people listening will know, is what we call the play bow in dogs, where a dog crouches on their forelimbs, they put their butt up in the air, they might wag their tail, and they may bark. And we have discovered that the play bow is used to ask another animal to play, but even in a more sophisticated way, it's used strategically to basically say, I'm going to bite you, Allison, but this is still play, so don't take this bite as being an aggressive or a predatory move. Or, I bite you really hard, and you stop playing, and you look at me, you cock your head from side to side, and you go, what in the world are you doing? And then I immediately do a play bow to say, I'm sorry, I apologize, please forgive me. And people are discovering this now in great apes, chimpanzees, hyenas, dogs, wolves, coyotes, and really what's exciting is as time goes on, people are going to discover that animals have developed these very, very sophisticated patterns of behavior that shows that they know right from wrong. If I invite you to play, it is wrong for me to try to eat you or dominate you or mate with you.
So you make a strong case in the book about animals and morality. What does it mean for humanity when we humans recognize the moral lives of animals?
Well, it's up in the ante. We know that animals are smart. You know, they've got great cognitive capacities. We know that they have rich and deep emotional lives. And when we start talking about moral behavior and moral sentiments and empathy and cooperation and reciprocity and justice, it means that they really, really need a respect. Mm-hmm. We need to respect the animals for who they are. We need to treat them with respect and dignity. And so it just really means that we need to change our ways and we can't any longer abuse them like we do it for food, for clothing, and research and education, for entertainment, because we're dealing with highly sentient, feeling beings.
Thank you for that. That's a great conclusion. And I've done a book review previous in the show that actually touched upon the messages that we can take from your book. So please tell us about your speaking appearance coming up in Vancouver on November 18th and what that will entail.
Well, I'll be talking about the moral lives of animals, what we call wild justice, and the emotional lives. And, I'll be basically covering a lot of what we covered in this interview, just showing examples after examples based on great scientific research about the moral lives and the emotional lives of animals and what it all means, why we need to use this information to treat animals better. And I'll also be talking about some of the work I do with a moon bear rescue in China, working with a wonderful group called Animals Asia.
That sounds great. Thank you, Mark, for coming on the show today to speak to us about the moral lives of animals, as written in your book, Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals. To find out more about Mark Beckhoff and his work, please visit his website, www.literati.net/Beckhoff. There is a link on our website, animalvoices.org, to it as well. And if you're in the Vancouver area, you are invited to watch him speak at the Interactive Futures Conference on November 18th. Go to www.interactivefutures.ca for more information on that. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you very much, Allison. Looking forward to my trip to BC.
And I just wanted to mention as well that he's also available on the web at www.markbeckhoff.com.
Well, thank you so much for that, Allison. That interview was really, really nice. I really enjoyed it. You've been listening to Animal Voices Radio Show on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. So next week on the show, we will be away for Remembrance Day, but we will have for you a fantastic encore episode from last November.
One of my favorite shows ever.
Yeah, I really love this story. Featuring an interview with the teen hero from Concordia, Kansas, Whitney Hillman, who stood up for herself in her high school class and said no to slaughtering and eating her pet chicken school project, and instead rescued Chicklet, the chicken, from death. It's a fascinating story that deserves repeating. Plus, on the show is also an interview with Stop BBC Animal Research, Brian Vincent, and Annette Perks. We here at Animal Voices show modestly ask you to keep connected with Animal Voices via the World Wide Web. You can also sign up to our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. Join us on Twitter, Animal Voices YVR. And please do send us your suggestions and comments to the show either on Facebook or via email, which is radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Also, please do check our website, www.animalvoices.org, where our shows can also be downloaded and listened to. If you appreciate the work we do here every week on Animal Voices, to bring original quality programming on topics of current animal issues and vegan lifestyle, please show us your support by making a donation to Animal Voices at Co-op Radio, because we do rely on your donations to keep the show on the air. To make a donation of $5, $10, $20, or whatever you can afford, simply go to www.cooperadio.org and click on Donate Now. And remember to indicate your donation that is going towards Animal Voices. And if you're in Canada and make a donation of at least $25 or more, your donation is tax deductible and every little bit helps, so we thank you for your assistance. We leave you today with a song which is appropriately illustrates the sentiments of animals depicted in our discussions of morality on today's show, To Be Free by Dr. Will Tuttle, off of the CD Animal Songs. So please tune in again next week. Thanks for listening, and remember to be kind to the animals.